Anyone who's traveled via jet can tell you, clouds are an interesting part of the experience. They add color and variety to the skyscape. They can obscure the ground, or the sky, depending on which side of the layer you're on. Some clouds are white and puffy, and some are dark and ominous, but almost all clouds represent bumpiness for the air traveler. Sometimes a little, sometimes a lot. When you climb to the clouds, you need to be wearing your seatbelt. Well, climb aboard the Datanauts jet as we have another discussion about moving to cloud, talking with our guest who will provide us with a seatbelt in the form of his lessons learned leveraging infrastructure as a service. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter, and with me is snazzy co-host Chris Wall at Chris Wall. And if you like Datanauts, you can find every show we've ever recorded over at packetpushers.net. Surf on over and click on Datanauts in the toolbar at the top. Joining us today, Mr. Steve Winwood. Steve, would you please introduce yourself to the Datanauts audience?
Hi there, my name is Steve Winwood. I'm a technical / infrastructure architect focusing on virtualization, networking, and cloud. With experience across a number of industries, including public sector, construction, and e-learning. In my current and previous positions, I've gained some really useful experience and learned plenty of lessons in cloud, and specifically infrastructure as a service, which I'm here today to talk about.
Let's start at the very beginning here. We want to level set by understanding why we would choose IaaS, infrastructure as a service. So maybe the right thing to start with is defining it. What is infrastructure as a service?
I suppose if we talk about all the different hosting options, we used to host everything on-premise or we'd have a colo data center. So hosting on-premise, your responsibilities are essentially everything: building, power, UPS generators, cooling, air conditioning, the racks, and then the hardware, hypervisors, running the virtual machines and your applications. You essentially manage everything. With colo, the provider is responsible for building, power, cooling, racks, but you still manage the hardware, hypervisor, virtual machines on top of that. With IaaS, it's as per colo, but the provider manages the hardware and the hypervisor, leaving you just to manage VMs and applications. So the provider will normally give you a web-based management orchestration platform or interface that lets you kind of manage your environment, your virtual environment, which is a part of their larger, bigger cloud environment.
Well, I'm thinking, danger, you're taking away the infrastructure. We're used to building out our own infrastructure, right? I mean, well, some of us are. I still like being a plumber every once in a while. When does IaaS, infrastructure as a service, make sense as an alternative to build your own?
I suppose where time frames are important. So if you're building it all yourself, that takes time. So weeks and months, you've got to procure kit, getting purchase orders signed off, getting quotes, get a kit delivered, and you've got to rack and stack it, configure it, build your OS, build your apps. With IaaS, typically the timeframes are much shorter, especially if you already have a relationship with the provider. But even if you haven't, it doesn't take long to go to Amazon, go to Azure, stick in your credit card details, and you're there, you can spin up VMs. So I've been involved in some projects where there wasn't time to build it ourselves. IaaS was the answer there.
Yeah, and one other thing about timeframes that you didn't mention was just how long it can take to get equipment in the door. I've been in situations where we would put in an equipment order and they'd be like, oh, those are back ordered for 6 or 8 weeks or something like that, which can add to your lead time to get stuff built.
Yeah, exactly. And it's us techies like to deal with the technology, but getting purchase orders signed off, doing the whole logistics side is often a bit of a pain.
When we were talking offline about this, you said security can come up as another one of those reasons why you'd want to do, I guess the way you say it is IaaS. Can you get into that a little bit?
Some people say, oh, the cloud, it's insecure. We don't know what's going on. We're going to get hacked. But actually, the cloud actually can be more secure. So a lot of providers have kind of pre-accredited secure environments to the relevant levels and standards. And that can save you time on deployment, as well as reduce your accreditation timescales and the amount of infrastructure you have to accredit.
In other words, they've got an environment. Yeah, when you move into this, it's blessed to meet these certain security criteria. And so you know when you stand up infrastructure as a service, but you stand up VMs on this infrastructure that we've got for you, you are secure?
Yeah, I mean, you still need to deploy your VMs in the right way. You will still need to get whatever you deploy on that environment accredited, but you've got less to worry about. So you're talking virtual machine hardening, firewall configs. You're not talking a deep level detail that you need to go into when you're accrediting a full environment. And that includes stuff like buildings as well. So building controls or lack of building controls and fire controls can affect your accreditation. So, you know, infrastructure service removes a lot of that headache.
When you're saying stuff like that, I'm thinking, yeah, obviously the application is only as secure as the application is, and it doesn't matter whose environment it's running in. If you have horribly written code that easily suffers a SQL injection or something, it doesn't matter if it's IaaS or not. But yeah, there's certain physical securities that could be catered to. And I'm also thinking, having worked in a lot of data centers where people install hardware and then just leave all the default security enabled, like, oh, what's the root access? It's admin. Password is admin. You know, like that's hopefully been abstracted away to someone else. And if they're more robust about physical security, you know, you're kind of renting time and resources on the infrastructure components, then they're handling all those headaches too. The physical type security access for root on a storage array, as an example. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like you say, you're still going to have security at the application level and the OS level. Both of those are your responsibilities. And if, you know, if you open up your cloud firewall to, you know, all internet traffic, you can have issues, but the fundamentals should be in place and you do have less to worry about.
What about the advantage from a cost perspective? Because I'm thinking you're really transferring CapEx kind of cost into OpEx kind of maintenance and ongoing renewal costs with IaaS, right? You're just kind of leasing time on the infrastructure, correct?
Yeah, that's it. So you can consume IaaS services in a number of ways from a cost point of view. Pay as you go. There are also subscription and minimum commit models as well. But more often than not, like you say, it's consumed in an OPEX model. So you pay for what you use and you haven't got those big upfront costs. And this is very appealing to businesses in today's day and age who don't want those big infrastructure costs that have to be funded by capital expenditure.
And then depreciated over time and all of that headache. You pay the subscription model. Well, it's a consumption model, I guess, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But I would say the cost model shouldn't be the only way of going to the IaaS. You can lease kit. If you don't want to get to cloud, you can lease kit. There's other ways of doing OPEX apart from cloud. And I do have to say that to people sometimes when they say, you know, we don't want to spend CapEx, so we need to go to the cloud. It's, well, there are other alternatives actually.
So let's say we have decided we are going to go to the cloud. IaaS is our choice for whatever reasons that made that the wise decision. How do I pick the right provider? There's a bunch of them. You're in the UK, I'm in the US, and there's providers all over the place. How do you start to choose one?
An interesting one is geography. So where are your services running out of and where is your data at the moment and where can it be? So you may have, as a business, contractual obligations to keep your data in certain locations, the UK, Europe, or if you're over in the US, keep it over in the US. That is one of the concerns of the cloud is, you know, where does your data end up?
You've got to qualify that with the provider and say, hey, I have a legal obligation to keep stuff resident in this physical geography. And they can or cannot guarantee that, I suppose.
Well, yeah. For example, Azure and Amazon haven't got, at the moment, presence in the UK. So Ireland's the closest one. That has been changed. And, you know, they are building out those points of presence now. But that's one big area where, in our past experience, we've not been able to use those services because the data was not in the UK. And there's also the Microsoft versus the US government case. The US government trying to demand customer data from Microsoft hosting in Ireland. Cases like that can have big ramifications. So people get nervous when their data could possibly leave their geographic areas.
So geography is one thing. What else am I looking at when choosing an IaaS provider?
We've touched upon security. So accreditation's another factor. So you need to ensure that the environment is accredited to the right level.
And in the UK, what does that mean? Can you be more specific with that?
Yeah, so in the UK, we used to have what they call impact levels, so IL0 to IL6. And basically, the higher the number, the more secure the data needed to be. That's now changed slightly, and there's now three levels when you're working with kind of government-level data. So there's official, secret, and top secret. And certain providers will meet certain standards. So for example, Azure is certified to hold official data. So if you've got that requirement, then you can rule out several providers by checking what level they're accredited to.
Does price factor in very much? Are they all priced pretty competitively? Or
they've all got helpful pricing calculators, so it's generally a case of working it out yourself. The commodity ones, you know, Azure or Amazon, they tend to be slightly cheaper than the more bespoke ones. I've used a couple of kind of more UK local providers, and you do tend to pay a bit of a premium for that service, because they might be security accredited to a higher level or have more than one data center in the UK. So they can charge a premium for that for UK customers because they know there's demand for that. In the wider scheme of things, it's normally a case of Amazon, Azure, whoever it is, are pretty competitive on the pricing. And, you know, one lowers the price, the next one normally follows. So it's worth just going through the calculators and working out how much it's going to cost you.
Now, you mentioned Amazon, and I know they're not even an option in your market, but you consider them to be the cheapest. If they were in your market, would there be some reason you might go for Amazon as compared to the bespoke, as you put it, providers?
Yeah, we'd definitely go for Amazon if it was, or when it is, when it will be available in the UK. I think they've got a really solid platform, and some of the bespoke ones, you don't always get the level of service or the same pricing point that you get with Amazon. Amazon's also got a great, you know, ecosystem. There's lots of products there. You know, you can do platform as a service as well as infrastructure as a service. You can stand up containers on it. It's a very flexible platform. The same with Azure as well. So I think a big barrier is being lifted for myself and other kind of UK consumers by the fact that both those two providers are now going to have a presence in the UK in the future.
It's an arms race of the marketplace, right? If you look at AWS's marketplace, it's like a full page nowadays on a high 4K monitor. There's so many different offerings and they're adding new ones. It feels like every month. That's just the arms race of who can write the features and support them. And Amazon's, it's a beast. They're the clear winner in that market. And they can discount as well. They've got the economies of scale working for them, which comes with discounts and negotiation, things like that. Whereas a boutique provider, just it's more of a struggle because anyone that's put together infrastructure for ISPs, MSPs, et cetera, they're always trying to get that lowest dollar per whatever unit it is. And that can be tough because you always have to have enough capacity to support anything people throw at you in a lot of cases. So economies of scale definitely play when you hit that kind of web scale size like AWS is.
One of the things I picked up on here that I was not expecting when having an infrastructure as a service conversation was that it could be possible to have more security than building it yourself. Putting it in the cloud, everybody always objects, oh, public cloud, it's not secure, and so on. And there's good reasons for that objection. But in fact, as Steve pointed out, there are circumstances where an IaaS provider may have built according to a very particular and stringent security spec. And if you're standing up virtual machines in that environment, you are in fact quite secure. And it may be more efficient for you to go that route than to try to build up your own infrastructure and secure it yourself. Again, an advantage I was not expecting.
Well, I like the idea of assigning value to time. I don't think it gets enough value. Maybe it's because we're paying people a salary and we just assume we own their time, but it's often underestimated. And if you look at a lot of things in the market, converged and hyper-converged infrastructure as examples, the big takeaway is they're simple and they're very quick. You can just put them in, you're done. So the ability to move forward with a project, solution, initiative in a timely manner, it's a huge advantage. You know, many projects just drag on for weeks or months and they just bleed time and money and skill resources out of the company. So I like that as a good reason to go down potentially the IaaS route.
Hi, this is Drew saying thanks to today's sponsor, InROP. InROP is the leading independent IT conference, and the Packet Pushers are putting together a two-day Future of Networking Summit for InROP Las Vegas 2016. The goal of the summit is to identify current and emerging technologies that are going to affect the networking industry over the next 5 to 10 years. And we're bringing in special guests, experts, practitioners, and of course, the Packet Pushers themselves. We'll talk about the changing state of network operations, advances in network hardware and silicon, open networking, SD-WAN, containers, and more. You can join us for live podcast recordings, and we'll have an after-hours hangout, too. And besides the Future of Networking Summit, InROP's assembling a full slate of independent, top-notch content on security, virtualization, IT leadership, SDN, and more. So make your plans now to join us at InROP Las Vegas, May 2nd through the 6th, at the beautiful Mandalay Bay Hotel. Use the code PPUSHERS when you register, and you can get 25% off 5-day, 3-day, and 2-day conference passes. We hope to see you there, and now back to the conversation.
We talked about some reasons that you might want to go to infrastructure as a service. Let's just say that you did. You're like, all right, IaaS, it's the best. Now, let's talk about app deployment. How is deploying your applications in the cloud different than deploying them locally, let's say?
Well, there's nothing to stop you deploying your apps in exactly the same way as you do on-premise in the cloud, but that's probably not the right way of doing it from my experience. A lot of other people out there in the market, there's a lot of case studies out there. Apps designed for the cloud work much better in infrastructure as a service. So large monolithic applications don't work well in the cloud. So, you know, if you need to spin up a Microsoft Exchange cluster or a big SQL cluster or SharePoint, I'm picking on Microsoft a bit here, but those services generally don't run well in an infrastructure as a service environment.
Now, what do you mean don't run well?
Take SQL as an example. You try and spin up a SQL cluster in any cloud environment, and what you find is a SQL cluster is designed to run in a very predictable environment, and you don't get that level of predictability in the cloud because it's a shared environment. You've got shared storage, shared hardware.
Okay. So you mean predictable, like you have as a SQL cluster, predictable access to IO buses and throughput you're going to get on the network and a predictable amount of writes you can do to storage, which you just may not get in the cloud, again, because of shared resources.
Or even when I would build things like that physically on premises, I would do them physically located next to each other, like cabinet to cabinet, same row. Mm. You can't even dictate that, right? They can put it anywhere in the data center. You're just some random hash GUID value that's being assigned.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's actually a knowledge-based article on how the changes you need to make to try and make a SQL cluster work in the cloud. So it's basically increasing all the cluster heartbeat timeouts and that kind of thing. And you still find that your cluster fails over all the time. It's those big non-cloud apps, as we'll call them, just don't seem to run well. Whereas if you look at where the industry and trends are going now with microservices, NoSQL rather than SQL, you know, Docker, it's cloud-native apps work much better in the cloud. A set of microservices, you've got small applications doing one function.
Maybe very short-lived.
That's right, yeah. Less persistent data, sessions don't matter as much. Those kind of apps are designed to deal with a bit of packet loss, a bit of latency, and, you know, not fall over.
So pets don't run that well in IaaS, but if I'm going from my legacy infrastructure and then moving my app up there, what choice do I have, you know? Because I can't necessarily retool my entire application infrastructure so that it runs better in cloud, or are there steps I can take to make things better?
People do retool, but it takes a long time. There's the story of Netflix in the press at the moment, you know, 7 years to move to the cloud because they had to retool their applications. There are some shortcuts you can take, I think. So, for example, looking at platform as a service offerings. So, you know, if you've got an application with a SQL backend on-premise, you want to move it to the cloud, well, don't try and build a SQL cluster. Get SQL as a service, or a database as a service, I should say. So Azure SQL, platform as a service, or Amazon Dynamo DB. There's ways around tolerating or removing the weak points of IaaS. You know, other options. So, you know, software as a service. So, you know, you need email in the cloud. Don't spin up Exchange, go for Office 365 or Gmail or whatever, and use platform as a service, software as a service, rather than trying to spin up your big monolithic applications.
You mentioned cloud infrastructure is shared, and in your experience, that sharing affected you pretty badly in some cases. Can you talk about some of the specifics of how having a shared cloud infrastructure hurt you guys when you were moving up to cloud?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first point is noisy neighbors. We sometimes have them at home. Well, in the cloud, you have noisy neighbors too. You want a shared infrastructure. You don't know what other services are running on the same hardware as you. There can be contention in those environments. So the providers, we talked briefly about providers having to have the capacity for the customer as well. They don't want loads of surplus capacity sat there being used. So the environments, by their nature, will be contended, and you may be affected by what other customers are doing. So an example might be backups. You know, on-premise, we schedule our backups for out of hours so they don't affect our services. But what you might find is another customer's maintenance backup window is the same time as your peaked traffic window. They carry out their scheduled backups. That puts extra load on the hardware, extra load on the storage, and that causes latency or performance issues on your applications.
Can I not pay my infrastructure as a service provider to guarantee me some sort of throughput? Or guarantee me a certain minimum amount of resources so that a noisy neighbor doesn't contend with me?
A lot of the public offerings, I've not seen that where they'll say, we'll give you a certain amount of I/O, CPU cycles or RAM reservations. I think if you've got more bespoke arrangements with providers, if they're building more of a or operating more of a private cloud for you, then you do have the option. But in the public cloud, normally it's all for grabs, really.
It's an oversubscription model. You're there along with everybody else, and if everybody's peaking at the same time, that's probably bad.
Exactly, and it's all factors that you haven't got control over, which can be frustrating when you've got the service desk calls coming in, complaints about the application, and there's not a lot you can do about it because it's caused by your noisy neighbors.
I mean, noisy neighbors are an issue even when you're on-prem. The difference being you can see it, you can control it, and you can account for it. You're dealing with multiple tenants potentially as an on-prem deployment, but you kind of own that. And this, you're just like kind of at the mercy of whatever is going on, and various SLAs can potentially mitigate it, but you don't actually know what's going on under the covers because they don't show it to you.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's that, I think, lack of visibility that us engineers can find quite frustrating. You know, use when you're managing it yourself, you know, if you've got a problem, you can see the whole spectrum and the whole spectrum of the infrastructure and investigate all of that to see where the problem lies. So is it network? Is it storage? Is it server hardware? Or you can at least speak to the teams. They can troubleshoot it on your behalf. When it's in IaaS, you think you're having issues. You sometimes have to prove to the provider that it's not your application or it's nothing you've done. It's actually an issue on their platform.
It's like being a network engineer, always having to prove that it's not you, basically.
Yeah. There's a few other areas to watch out for as well. So there's also platform outages. So no provider's perfect, and it's inevitable that there will be downtime, be it planned or unplanned. But whereas with your on-premise infrastructure, you can influence when the downtime may be, and you can make sure it's outside your windows.
Wait, though. Wait a minute. This is cloud, and it's all supposed to be magic. I'm running on this virtual infrastructure, and my provider has to take an outage of some kind. Wouldn't my machine just automatically be migrated away? And in an unplanned event, wouldn't there be redundancy built in so that if my service dies, it's going to kick back up again on some other machines?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's resiliency there. And quite often, if there's an outage, it's more of a loss of resiliency than an actual full outage. But then again, sometimes providers have catastrophic problems where a whole region might go down. You know, they might lose the whole of their data center. You know, that happens every now and then.
Which is never supposed to happen.
Never supposed to happen. But if you're not geographically split, then if all your services are in one location, you're going to be hit by that. You do have to prepare for that. It's like designing it yourself on-premise. You know, if you need site resilience, you build two data centers, you know, reasonable distance apart. You know, if you need that in the cloud, then, you know, you need a provider with that facility and you need to split your services.
Which is something you have to pay attention to. You need to make sure that you're taking advantage of what resiliency options are there to avoid a catastrophic geographic outage taking out your whole service.
Exactly, yeah. Most of these cloud providers have shared infrastructure, as we've already talked about. So that's, you know, shared internet links, shared firewalls. And had issues in the past where another customer's been DDoSed and it's taken our service down as well because we were on the same infrastructure. So, you know, attacks on other customers can also affect you. So the way to mitigate that is ensuring your cloud provider has adequate DDoS protection. Some offer DDoS services, but really there's no point if you take a DDoS service out on yourself, so anti-DDoS service, and, you know, the customer also using your infrastructure hasn't got that service, then it can still affect you.
Is there any way you can get around that? Or is that just, it's almost like the noisy neighbor problem in a way.
Yeah, it's a similar issue. It's the fact that you're sharing infrastructure with other customers, and DDoS is something that, yeah, is going to happen. So, like I say, some providers will have protection against it, but we have been hit in the past where we have been taken or had downtime because of DDoS and other customers.
As I'm thinking about what you're saying about infrastructure as a service and deploying apps, I'm kind of thinking, all right, as an engineer, I just want to roll up my sleeves, jump in and start building some stuff. Seems like maybe that's a bad idea with infrastructure as a service. What's your thoughts around that?
Yes and no, really. I'd say learn yourself by jumping in. Take out a free AWS trial, or, you know, if you've got an MSDN subscription, you can get credits for Azure, or, you know, take out a free vCloud Air trial. By all means, learn by doing, but don't learn in production by just jumping in. It's a mistake that I've made in the past where you're buying a service from, you know, whoever. You see it as a commodity service, so it's, you know, it's a bit like going to a supermarket and buying a tin of baked beans or whatever. You know, you just think they're offering a service, you're consuming it, and there's no real relationship there. Where actually what I've found is you can speak to providers beforehand and they're normally more than willing to help you with best practice, gotchas, how best to consume their infrastructure. So it's definitely better to speak to the providers beforehand, rather than just diving in there, spinning up some VMs, spinning up some networks, and seeing how it all works.
That's great. great to hear someone bring up a point that should just be a self-evident truth, but I don't think it gets the attention it deserves sometimes. It's that cloud is not a band-aid for highly available design. You can't just stick stuff in a cloud and say, well, it's this big puffy cloud, it won't go away. I mean, every time I see the news journal rags, etc., go, you know, oh, there was an outage in whatever zone and all these applications are down. It's like, really? You guys didn't have any other plans? You still need multiple sites or regions or zones or whatever the vendor is calling them to ensure that your applications remain online to service requests. Bad things happen.
IIS, it's a service, right? And one of the things is, from a networking background, that I immediately thought of was dealing with networking service providers. Now, in that market, you can usually, if you're willing to pay for it, get a guaranteed level of service so that on this WAN circuit, let's say, that it interconnects two of your sites, you know that that provider is giving you a certain amount of bandwidth guarantee and quality of service across that link. Again, typically you have to pay for that additional service, but it doesn't sound like there necessarily is going to be that option in public cloud. There's no guarantees, and you're very definitely on an oversubscribed platform that you're sharing with other people. And therefore, if your application is ultra sensitive to not having enough CPU or being RAM bound a little bit or contending for resources in some other way, that's something you need to carefully consider as you go to IIS deployment. And it kind of surprised me in that I was anticipating Steve to say, oh yeah, you can. If you're willing to pay for it, they'll give you whatever you want. It might not necessarily be the case. Steve, I want to move into money. I want to understand what it really costs me to run IIS. I mean, we talked in the beginning how OpEx could be an advantage depending on, I don't want to put a lot of CapEx money out the door. I'd rather just spend a little bit of money month to month, or it could be a lot of money. And I guess that's really the question. In your experience, what is the billing model of IIS?
Most providers have a number of different models. There's a strict pay-as-you-go model where you normally register a credit card and you literally pay for what you use, or maybe the provider bills you at the end of the month for what you use during that month. It's literally your VM's running for 20 days in a month. You get charged 20 days of run rate for that VM. It's normally charged per hour. There's also subscription models. So you pay for a certain level of resources and commit to a certain level of resources. And quite often with that, you know, you might pay for, I don't know, 200 gig of RAM and 50 gig of CPU resources and a terabyte of storage. And no matter what you use up to that point, you pay a fixed rate. And then sometimes you can burst above. But if you're below that, you're just paying a flat price. There's also some providers do dedicated models where you can get dedicated compute or dedicated storage and you effectively rent those services. But most providers, they like to get you hooked on pay-as-you-go, but they incentivize customers to commit to a subscription because at the end of the day, that helps with their capacity management as well. If they've got all their customers on pay-as-you-go and you know they could all burst out to unbelievable levels, that gives them quite a big capacity headache. Whereas if they've got customers on subscription models, they can better predict what their utilization is going to be.
Because they don't want to have more hardware out there than they need to support what they need, because that adds to their cost. They're trying to maximize their own utilization on the hardware that they've got out there. And so, right, a certain model means they can better estimate just how much gear they got to have in play to support what everybody's likely to be doing.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. It's all about, you know, it's, we talked about noisy neighbors, we talked about overutilization. Well, they've, you know, the providers, to be fair to them, they've got a very fine balance between, you know, being a profitable company, providing a decent service as well.
So I've always thought of a lot of those things like renting a car versus buying a car. Ultimately, renting costs more, but you don't have to worry about maintenance and things like that. So putting that in the framework of infrastructure as a service, is it relatively cheap versus buying all this stuff yourself and I guess the operational expenses that you kind of lose out on when you have to operate and own all this stuff?
It really depends on how you consume it. So for short-term scale out or where you've got a lot of varied demand, yeah, absolutely, IaaS can help there because you can consume as much as you need and you're not going to worry about buying extra equipment for maybe a three-month busy period of the year and have it sat there for the rest of the year not doing anything. Where you might find that IaaS isn't as cost effective is if you've got very consistent 24/7 running of services. So in that case, quite often you can build and run it yourself for cheaper in the long term. So it's always worth working out the payback period of building it yourself and hosting it yourself or in colo, as opposed to infrastructure as a service.
It's not a slam dunk then. I mean, it's not an obvious, oh gosh, as soon as I can shut down this data center, I'm going to save so much money by moving everything to the cloud. Sounds like it's definitely not as simple as that.
No, it's not. But, you know, it's with a lot of businesses don't have the appetite for spending that money upfront. And you can say to a business, well, you know, the payback period of this service is, you know, 18 months. So in 18 months of running IaaS, we could have built it ourselves for the same money. And 18 months onwards, we're saving money. It's effectively almost free. But, you know, the business will still say, hey, it's only X amount a month. I don't care about that.
Yeah, in theory, though, you're stuck with a CapEx if you build it yourself. And that is a very clearly defined financial expenditure. Whereas with cloud, I mean, have you seen prices trend down over time where that 18-month period, you start out paying X, but then 6 months in, you get a price reduction?
Yeah, it's not unusual for prices to come down. So that absolutely happens. But you never really see a reduction in your run rate because you're always building new services. So it's kind of your estate naturally just seems to grow larger and larger. So as prices come down, in reality, it's more of a leveler really.
Whereas if you'd built it yourself, you'd have headroom that you could stand more services up on. In cloud, your as your run rate grows, your expenditure grows.
That's right, yeah. But I'd say actually an advantage of that, though, is that cloud gets away from this notion that IT is free. So maybe the company's gone out, they've bought some kit on the CapEx. They then keep spinning up new VMs on that kit and using it, and they don't see that as a cost. They've got a platform there. They need a new environment, can spin up on the platform, and it's not cost us anything. That's a dangerous habit to get into because eventually it does cost you. What I find in my experience is the first project that comes along has to build something, and then the subsequent projects afterwards can just piggyback on that infrastructure. Whereas with IaaS and cloud, you know, because you're paying for what you use, it can actually be very prescriptive with how much it's going to cost you and feed that back to the business.
Yeah, I like that. That makes good sense. As you say, IT isn't in actuality free, but it can feel that way in certain circumstances. Whereas cloud, this is what it's going to cost you to do this. Do you have any tips on how to reduce IaaS cost? I mean, I've looked at those hourly rates and kind of winced inside a little bit going, man, that's going to add up quick. What have you run into? Have you figured out ways to keep those costs under control?
Yeah, so the first thing is get the right plan in the first place. So the right cost model, be that a subscription model or pay-as-you-go, and then you can really fit your usage around that. If you need consistent capacity 24/7, then a subscription model absolutely makes sense, and that'll probably be cheaper than running it 24/7 on a pay-as-you-go. Whereas if you've got the ability to turn your VMs off out of hours, automate, scale automatically, then absolutely a pay-as-you-go model makes sense because you can be more efficient with the way you use resources. So it makes sense to only pay when you're truly using them. So I've been in environments where we turn off dev and test at night automatically via scripts. That saves massively on the cost. Effectively, it can halve your running costs.
I mean, there's still long-term storage you're using, but you're not using compute, you're not using memory, and so you're saving money there.
That's right, yeah. And as a portion of the cost, unless you've got massive amounts of storage deployed, the cost of storage on a VM while a VM's turned off is minuscule compared to the run rate of the actual VM. I'd also say is with IaaS, you have to tidy up after yourself. So us engineers are really bad at deleting stuff when we don't need it anymore. So you end up with loads of stale servers on your on-premise VM environment. Well, in the cloud, you're paying for all that. So you need to tidy up after yourself, delete stuff when it's not needed, clear down the old environments because otherwise the business is paying for it. And also size your VMs right. So don't give every VM 8 CPUs and 64 gig of RAM because you're paying for that. Size your VMs right, you start low because it's very easy to scale up when you need to.
Yeah, and some of the providers have, you know, I know Amazon has CloudWatch to look at what's going on, what are you using. They'll even recommend, hey, you should turn off these 30 different workloads because they're not doing anything. So that there's some stuff where maybe people just aren't looking at it, but there's ways that can help poke apart what's going on because I know as the infrastructure person, I might not have any clue what this M4 large is doing, but if CloudWatch is saying, hey, it's not doing very much, I could at least either just turn it off and wait to hear if someone complains or actually reach out to whoever the CMDB owner is and say, hey, we need to start scheduling this to be off at some point.
Exactly, yeah. It's all about having decent reporting and using the tools to work out what your demand is and what resources are required. So you have a decent monitoring infrastructure, you know, look at your performance metrics. And you can even do some funky automation. And when your cluster of web servers, you know, reaches 80% CPU, you can automatically do scripts to build extra web servers and introduce them into the kind of web farm. There's lots you can do to use the cloud in an efficient way that's actually a bit of a pain to do on-premise. Whereas in the cloud, all the tools are there to do it for you.
Well, that seems like a good place for us to call it on this edition of the Datanauts podcast. Steve, I want to thank you for approaching us with all the lessons learned and working with us to assemble this show and sharing your wisdom. Is there somewhere on the internet that people can follow you?
Well, yeah, thanks for having me on the show. It's been really interesting. I'm on Twitter at Steve H. Winwood. Also on LinkedIn. I should blog, but I don't, so there's no blog, I'm afraid.
No problem. That is it then for today's Datanauts podcast. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter, and my blog is ethancbanks.com. And Chris, of course, is at Chris Wall on Twitter, and wallnetwork.com is where you can find his superb writing. And for more Datanauts podcasts, steer your jet car over to packetpushers.net and land on almost an endless runway of podcast goodness. And by the way, if you're a vendor interested in coming on to talk to a super nerdy engineering crowd about your product, hey, we're taking sponsors, and you can reach out to us, packetpushers@gmail.com, and let us know you're interested in that, and we will get you the details. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
I'm being DDoSed by a crane.
So professional. Throat clearing. Oh.
At least they're muted.
That's a wrap.